About 30 people killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds more still missing. All of that happening on the tiny island of Bahrain, 750 square kilometers, barely over a million people, 70% of whom happen to be Shia. Shias suppressed by a minority government backed by Saudi Arabia and the United States. Is the world hearing enough about what's happening on the ground in Bahrain as we speak? For that and more, we're joined from London by Saeed Shahabi, head of Bahrain Freedom Movement. From Beirut by Jamal Wakim, political analyst. From Washington by Hussein Abdullah, director of Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain. And from Boston by John Hajar, U.S. director of the Cedar Revolution. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. We're also joined from London and Beirut by our panels of audience. I'd like to start, if I may, with Saeed Shahabi, joining us from London, head of Bahrain Freedom Movement. Everyone wants to know what's happening on the ground in Bahrain, and why is it we're not hearing enough or seeing enough off of mainstream media?
Thank you very much. What is happening in Bahrain today is something that approaches a catastrophe, a human catastrophe, in the sense that the regime has been left on its free will to do whatever it likes with the people who have no one to protect them but God. In the past 3-4 weeks, they have been subjected to the most ferocious attacks by the invasion of the Saudis and by the local security and military forces. Their houses of worship have been destroyed. Mosques were demolished. As even today, one mosque has been destroyed. Yesterday, another mosque was destroyed. And almost on a daily basis, their mosques are destroyed. The people are being killed inside jail. The latest victim was martyred yesterday. Karim Fakhrawi, of 49 years of age, was murdered under torture, and today the images of his mutilated body were shown on various websites and in some TV stations. Also, at the same time, we have seen how these thugs, these armed militias wielding swords and axes, have been attacking villages, towns, manning checkpoints at the entrance to villages, and the whole country has been placed under one of the most bleakest eras and situations that can ever be imagined under the mercy of those merciless people. So the country is undergoing a very, very difficult period.
Now, let me go around our guests and say about their take on what's happening on the ground in Bahrain. Jamal Wakim, let's have your take.
Well, what's going on in Bahrain is deeply rooted in history. Mainly, it's pictured as a Shia-Sunni clash, but it's rather a tribal clash between the original inhabitants of Bahrain, who have lived in Bahrain for too many centuries, and a fraction of the Neza tribe coming from the Najd area in eastern Saudi Arabia in the late 18th century, and they were able to dominate the country and all its resources and discriminate against the original inhabitants of this country. So this is where we can look for the origins of this conflict. So I think that this is the core of the conflict in Bahrain.
Right.
On the local level. Of course, we have a regional and international dimension, especially
we'll check out the regional and international dimension later on during the show. But let's move on to Boston. John Hajar, let me have your take on what's happening on the ground in Bahrain and the cause of all this. For 2 months, people have been on the streets fighting, dying, and, well, places like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, so on and so forth, other NGOs are condemning the actions on the ground, but not much mainstream media.
Thank you, and it is regrettable that there is not more coverage from mainstream media of all of these revolutions taking place throughout the Middle East. Indeed, the Bahraini people are expressing their desire to live in a free, democratic, and open society, and their leadership has failed to heed their legitimate concerns and to really to grant them the concessions that they should have undertaken years and years ago. And, unfortunately, all these despotic regimes throughout the region are waking up and realizing that the rest of populations are not going to tolerate living under the conditions they've been living under for decades, going back many, many years. So the people are suffering, and they are being brutally put down, and their legitimate aspirations should be taken into account by the leaders of Bahrain. However, there is a foreign element as well, and we'll get to that later. But the Islamic Republic is inserting its operatives both through Hezbollah and through the Iranian besiege and Republican Guards. And they're sowing further discord among the people and making the situation worse.
All right, we'll discuss this later, but as reports have it, what little we're getting from what's happening on the ground in Bahrain, it's Saudi forces plus the PGCC country forces on the ground in Bahrain. We'll discuss that in detail in just a few minutes, but I'd like to go to Washington.
Additionally, the Saudis are involved as well.
Yeah, we're going to Washington, D.C. Hossein Abdullah. All right, people have been on the streets. What is the cause? What is it people want from where you stand?
Bahrain used to be the Garden of Eden. Right now, Bahrain is a forest of torture, of human rights violation. The people of Bahrain rose up not only on February 14th, these recent uprising, but since the early 50s, demanding their natural place in their country, their demanding political representation, demanding their human rights to be respected, demanding that they take part in the decision-making process in their country, demanding to have a legislative body that is fully powered, demanding that there be no sectarian discrimination in the country, demanding to take in part and their national army, wanted to have a government that is elected by the people, represented by the people, not 80% of it or 70% of it by the Al Khalifa ruling family. People of Bahrain, their movement is no different than the movement of Tunisia or Egypt, where people want to take their natural role in the 21st century, where have a government by the people, for the people, no longer by the elite and only for the elite.
Now, let me go to our studio in London, the audience. London, from what you say in TV screens, first, how much coverage do you think is given to all of this from London, where you guys are, cable TV or national TV or BBC, so on and so forth? And let me have your perspective.
Well, actually, in my opinion, there's hardly any coverage. And actually, that is my question. Why isn't there more media coverage on this atrocity?
That's a really good question. Let me pose this question because it's a very important question. Let me pose this to Saeed Shahabi. Saeed Shahabi, why no coverage, almost zero in some places, some mainstream media, well, some coverage. Why?
Well, we must understand that regardless of the freedom we talk about when we mentioned this media in the West, in the UK or in America, usually the media is influenced somehow by the Foreign Office. There is a daily briefing at the Foreign Office, and usually the ideas that come from the Foreign Office will dominate the news. So this is one reason. The other reason is that the Bahrain is is also presented not as a national revolution, but as a sectarian one. This has been presented in this way by the regime, which is completely opposite to the reality. The reality in Bahrain is not sectarianism. The reality is that it is no difference in any sense from the revolutions in Egypt or in Tunisia or in Yemen or in Libya. All the Arab countries are suffering from dictatorships, tyrannies, and the people want to express their views and want some change. That is the that's what's happening in Bahrain. But the mainstream media, unfortunately, is influenced. Of course, we must not forget that also Saudi Arabia is pumping millions of dollars and pounds into the media, into public relations. Bahrain is served by at least four public relations companies which are spinning the whole thing and trying to change the reality of the situation.
Let me ask you this before I go back to our studio in London. Let me ask you this. All right, we're saying it's not about sectarianism, it's not about sectarian conflicts, but inside Bahrain, almost 70% Shia majority. They say we're suppressed by a minority government backed by some regional powers like Saudi Arabia and others, and then backed by Washington, D.C. That's what they're saying. Maybe it's not a people's thing, the sectarianism. Maybe it's something coming from outside, people from outside not wanting the Shias to have a voice in there for certain fears. Let me have your take on that.
You see, there is no other defense by the regime. They can't say anything. When you have all the people in the streets, how else can it defend itself apart from trying to either blame the whole movement on the outside, the whole troubles on the outside, or describe the people as sectarian people? The first mention of sectarianism came when the foreign minister, 5 days after the revolution, after the attack on the Pearl Square, came to the press conference following the GCC's foreign minister's meeting and said that, in Bahrain we are suffering from sectarianism and we saw that this is a sectarian movement, so we had to kill it. And then the Crown Prince repeated the same thing. He knows and they all know that the people of Bahrain, both Shias and Sunnis, are united in their demand. Apart from those who are working with the regime, there is a hereditary dictatorship which represents only maybe 1 or 2% of the population, which is dominating the political arena.
All right.
This has to change. This is very old. It cannot be allowed to continue.
With that, let me go back to London, our London studio with the audience. Audience in London, why do you think you're not... Let me have the opinion in the back seat. Go ahead. Let me have the gentleman. Go ahead.
The sectarianism question arose also in the Egyptian revolution. And everyone on the news watched the Egyptian people, Muslims and Christians, against the Egyptian regime. So what I'm thinking of is it needed for the Bahraini people to show the whole world that they are united against the regime and to get what they are after.
But let me ask you, London, even if all the people are on the streets, if there's not coverage, how could the world know what's happening on the streets in Bahrain, as one of the members of the audience simply suggested that in London you're not getting much coverage?
I have to totally agree with that, because as he spoke about Egypt, I do think that Egypt, they succeeded when they did that, and I think if the Bahrainian people don't do what they are doing, then they won't get anywhere, and the world needs to know what is going on in the Arab countries.
All right, that's a good question, and I'd like to pose it to our panel, because let me go to Jamal Wakim in Beirut. Jamal, people in Egypt made it, she says. Why is it people in Bahrain haven't made it so far? The difference?
Well, because it's a totally different context. In Egypt, it's a big country. People are more urbanized They have been more urbanized, especially in the past four decades. The ruling elite in Egypt was less tribal. In Bahrain, first, it's highly influenced by Saudi politics. The minority ruling, or the dynasty that is ruling, actually, Bahrain, is a tribe that is ruling a whole country. Bahrain has a very, it's a small country. The people there are not as numerous as in Egypt, so that they can be more easily be controlled by the state, especially the state that is supported by Saudi Arabia. So all these factors led to the fact that the Bahraini people were not able to make it so far. And even in Egypt, they have been partially successful in the sense that they were able to oust the president and his closest associates, but they didn't. This did not lead to a regime change. Actually, what we're seeing in Egypt is a continuation of the past regime. So, same is happening in Bahrain, a tiny country where the dynasty was about to go to concessions had it not been for Saudi intervention, which blocked these concessions and made, let's say, the dynasty in Bahrain call for now, Saudi intervention.
Can we
that it would crack down on the people's rebellion.
All right, I'd like to go to Hussein Abdullah in Washington. Can we bring in the foreign factor right now? Why is it the people in Egypt, for example, made it? Because we had the backers of the Egyptian president calling him, telling him to hold your fire, step down, so on and so forth, and the so-called international community siding with the people. Only after things actually turned really against the government, whereas in Bahrain, the situation has been so far that we've had the PGCC member states sending troops over, especially led by Saudi Arabia, and Washington's silence, if you will, on the issue. How important has that foreign factor been in all of this?
Well, there are two main reasons. One, the domino effect. I've said it before, Bahrain is the key to the Persian Gulf. I mean, if Bahrain fall, become democratic, the revolution in Bahrain or the uprising in Bahrain become successful, then the whole GCC is up for grab. The people in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Oman going to ask themselves, if the Bahrainis can do it, we can do it too. Or if the Bahraini did it, we can do it too. If Bahrainis can choose their leader, why can't we? The other thing is the domino effect. You see, the United States, or the if the United States knew that supporting the revolution in Tunisia to some extent, or Egypt, to reluctantly going to have this wave of democratization in the region, whether it's Yemen, Libya, Bahrain, partly Oman, and now Syria, they would probably be more cautious at that time, or they would have been more cautious not to come on the side of the people reluctantly, because I think right now they have too much on their plate. They have the situation in Libya. They have the situation in Yemen, in Oman, in Syria. So it is like they're more overwhelmed that these regime change, what they're going to do to their interest in the region, and especially in the GCC, the people of Bahrain not only facing the Al Khalifa, they're facing the whole GCC regime.
That's the question too for Boston. What is the difference between Bahrain and other Arab countries? Now, Washington's silence on Bahrain is quite tangible, quite noticeable. And then also the position taken by the GCC, the PGCC, also quite noticeable. So what's the difference here?
I agree with Mr. Abdullah in D.C. The U.S. policy has been somewhat incoherent, and we here in the States have our hands full. You know, at one point you have the Secretary of State, Clinton, saying something wholly opposite of what the president is saying. So, you know, between our involvement in Iraq, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and now in Libya, you know, the U.S. Is stretched thin, and we have been, the administration has now recently involved themselves in Libya. And, you know, they're trying to articulate a doctrine of supporting the aspirations of the people. And I think The President Obama has done that, but the whole area is blowing up, and I think the I agree also with Mr. Shahabi in London that the whole region now is the revolution's taking place throughout the area. However, I think there's a if you look to Syria, you also see the people rising up. And they're not getting noticed either. So it's not just in Bahrain where there's a lack of coverage. And there's another factor as well, the crowding out by the news cycle right now with the natural disaster that struck the Japanese. There's been a lot of coverage dedicated to that. And seemingly there is a new revolution in the Arab world, you know, by the day. So there has not been enough coverage, and hopefully there'll be more.
All right. Now let's go to our panel of audience in Beirut, in this region, in the Middle East. Beirut, let me have your take on what's happening on the ground in Bahrain, and what are you guys hearing?
I just wanted to say, I think there are a few things we have to remember when it comes to Bahrain. One is that the subtleties of the context of the situation, it being that this is actually the biggest revolution in the Arab world relative to its population. There are 100,000 Bahrainis on the streets calling for their rights, which relative to a population of 600,000 Bahrainis makes it the largest Arab street revolution that we have seen yet. And yet it's facing a very strong it's facing very strong repression from its Sunni from the Sunni monarchy regime, which of course with Saudi troops that have been deployed there are also helping the further repression of the street demonstrations. I just also wanted to make a point about the mainstream media. Also here in the Arab world, including in Lebanon, there has not been that much coverage of the Bahraini revolution. There are our main news organizations here, Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera, are funded by the Gulf countries. We have had little coverage of Bahrain in comparison to Libya and Yemen, and of course Egypt, the West, and the Arab world covered it 24/7 during that time. Of course it was the only revolution after Tunisia. So it did have exclusive coverage, but there are other ulterior motives and agendas there.
I would like to just also add, in regard to the comparison of Egypt and Bahrain, the Egyptian revolution would not have succeeded in toppling Hosni Mubarak if there was an extensive 24/7 coverage by the media, particularly the Western media. I mean, CNN was hooked onto the story in Egypt. Every day when I watched CNN, they were only talking about Egypt. That put pressure on President Barack Obama. Even if he didn't want to support the people of Egypt, he had no choice because the American people were being swayed by what they saw on TV. So that's why the Egyptian revolution was a success in terms of toppling Mubarak, and that's why this revolution in Bahrain will have a tough time because they don't have the same media support that the Egyptian revolution did. Thank you.
Now, I see hands raised in London, in our London studio. Let's have a couple of opinions from London.
I wanted to just to comment on Egypt and Bahrain. I don't think that a revolution in Egypt was successfully yet because the military is in lead, and that is, I just don't think that, I think there should be a civilian government.
Yeah, I believe that also in the UK and the US's interests have kind of moved. So with the case of Egypt, they wanted Hosni Mubarak to fall in the end. It was such a popular uprising. We're seeing a popular uprising in Bahrain as well, but it's not actually in the US or UK's interest to have that regime change because they believe that to get stability in the country, they need that regime to still be there.
All right, another gentleman in London. Our final comment for this half of the show.
Yeah, I just want to bring a point or a question to the guy in Boston. What it is, yeah? How come it is, they always play the blame game? You know, before it was Al-Qaeda doing this, and then now Iran supporting this. You know, well, why can't the West face up, hands up, look, we got our think tank, our policies wrong, and let the people in the Middle East, in Africa, get on with their lives? You know, don't interfere. We or anyone in their own country can deal with their own problems. So I want the guy in Boston, please reply to my point.
All right. When we're back, because right now we're done for this half of the show, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll also answer that question. But How can the people on the streets of Bahrain really find their voice? How can the international community hear their voice when they're not simply over TV, especially mainstream media? And why is it they're not there in the first place? We're back with The Link discussing the situation on the ground in Bahrain as we speak. Almost 30 people already killed, hundreds more injured, and hundreds missing over the past 2 months. Why? What's happening? And what does the future hold for Bahrain? For that and more, we're joined from London by Saeed Shahabi, head of Bahrain Freedom Movement, from Beirut by Jamal Wakim, political analyst from Washington, D.C., by Hossein Abdullah, director of Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain, and from Boston by John Hajjar, U.S. director of the Cedar Revolution. I'd like to start with Saeed Shahabi. Saeed Shahabi, maybe you can call us some kind of an ignored revolution in Bahrain, ignored by the Western media, by Arab neighbors of the country for certain reasons. You said it's not about sectarianism, but certainly countries of the PGCC, of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and others do not want to see the 70% Shia majority to reach simply their rights of at least equality with their Sunni brothers in government, so on and so forth. So how could the Bahrainis, Sunni and Shia, finally find their voice when forces outside their country help their government suppress the voices?
Well, I think the people will continue their revolution, whatever the cost may be. This is one point. The other point is that we must not forget what I call that the counter-revolution that is being led now by Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have invested heavily in countering the revolutions, not only in Bahrain, but in the other countries. And one of the commentators just now from the audience, he mentioned that I don't consider that the revolution in Egypt is complete. I agree with her. Neither the revolution in Egypt has been completed, nor the one in Tunisia or in Yemen or in Libya, because there is a very strong current being led by Saudi Arabia, invested heavily by in terms of money and political influence and domination. The Saudis, in alliance with the United States, Britain, and Israel, have come together, have joined forces soon after the downfall of Hosni Mubarak, and they decided that revolutions have no place in the Arab world. And even in those countries where the presidents had fallen, still there is a very serious engineering work going behind the scenes to ensure that the people of Egypt do not get what they want. They will only get little bit of what they want. And this is the same thing happening in Bahrain. Of course, in the situation of Bahrain, we have seen earlier, you have asked about the lack of interest of the media. Let us not forget, for example, that Al Jazeera, the Arabic channel, satellite channel, had played major role in Tunis and in Egypt and now in Yemen and in Libya. But in Bahrain, zero. They simply do not know whether there is anything going on in Bahrain. They simply do not cover even the smallest news. They didn't put anything there.
Why not?
So there is, well, I don't know. It seems to me that Qatar is a member of the GCC, and for one reason or another, they do not want to see a revolution similar to the one in Egypt, uprooting the regime and establishing the people's representative government. I don't know what is going on, but also most likely that there's a lot of pressure on Qatar, either from America or from Saudi Arabia or from both, not to put a lot of emphasis on the situation in Bahrain.
Right.
So Qatar, unfortunately, has not really lived up to its reputation and support by supporting all the revolutions in the same way.
Now, you talked about a counter-revolution launched by Saudi Arabia, and earlier in the show, your first comments had to deal with mosques being burned inside Bahrain, with everyone being a Muslim out there. There are reports that link the mosques being burned with Saudi forces on the ground in Bahrain.
Well, it seems to me that it is a counter-revolution in Bahrain that doesn't only aim at putting off or extinguishing the flames of the revolution, but uprooting the people who have caused it. Now, the situation in Bahrain is being sectarianized, not by the people, but by Saudi Arabia and by the ruling family in Bahrain. They want to really prove that it is a sectarian one by targeting a specific faction of the society, and that is the Shia. This is why we saw their mosques being burnt. Yesterday, the interior minister sat down with the leaders of the Matams or the Husseini congregation halls and told them that from now on, no more processions during Ashura or during the other times, and you have to do everything inside mosque and no later than 9 p.m. Their ulama, their scholars are in jail. Their human rights defenders are all in jail. More than 30 women are languishing behind bars and are being subjected to most horrific forms of torture. So we are seeing not just a small counter-revolution, but a counter-revolution that aims at the whole of the Arab world, and specifically in Bahrain, aims at uprooting the people who have started targeting their faith and really destroying their identity.
Let's see if Jamal Wakeem's share that, the idea of a counter-revolution launched by Saudi Arabia, and why.
Well, I totally agree with this point of view because Saudi Arabia is very anxious about the situation in the eastern part of the country, which is predominantly populated by a Shia population. They fear that if the rebellion in Bahrain is successful in ousting the dynasty that is ruling Bahrain for nearly two centuries now, this will affect the situation in Saudi Arabia. This will encourage the population of the eastern part of the country to rise in rebellion. Of course, other parts of Saudi Arabia will follow suit because there is a big complaint about the way the Saudi dynasty is running the country, the way it's absorbing and abusing all the resources of the country for its own interests. So they fear for their own security and for their own stability. That's why they were keen on intervening in Bahrain. Not only that, they were also keen on trying to absorb and contain the situation in Yemen because they were surrounded by two revolutions from two different sides. And they tried to discredit this genuine and authentic revolution by trying to lay the blame on Iran, that this is a rebellion instigated by Iran which is seeking regional influence, which is not the case because the Bahraini opposition has always been keen on the sovereignty of Bahrain. They were offered during the days of the Shah, for example, they were offered this option of joining Iran. They refused this option because they believe in the sovereignty of their country. So these claims are totally not founded.
All right, now let me take this to Boston, John Hajjar, because earlier he suggested Iranian influence out there. Now we have other panelists talking about Saudi Arabia and a counter-revolution out there. And before I hear your response to this, an article published in the Harper's Magazine by John MacArthur titled "The Vast Power of Saudi Lobby" goes, "The long and corrupt history of American-Saudi relations centers around the kingdom's vast reserves of easily extractable oil." Of course, ever since President Franklin D. Roosevelt met aboard a ship in 1945 with King Ibn Saud, the special relationship with the Desert Kingdom has only grown stronger. The House of Saud is usually happy to sell us oil at a consistent and reasonable price and then increase production if unseemly market forces drive the world price of a barrel too high for U.S. consumers. In exchange, we arm the Saudis to the teeth and turn a blind eye to their medieval approach to crime and punishment." And this time around, of course, the situation on the ground in Bahrain. Your take.
Oh, I agree. I think the panelists make good points that the Saudis are looking at their interests, and unquestionably they have dealt brutally and with their own domestic population at times, and with neighboring states. But the U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia has been too much of an accommodationist policy, where we've looked the other way in exchange for a free flow of oil. No questions asked. But to say that the Islamic Republic of Iran, is not interfering as well in Bahrain and in Yemen, in an area where I'm a little bit more expert, in Lebanon. I mean, they have been supporting Hezbollah
since
Hezbollah is a branch
John
of the
Najjar,
Islamic Republican Guards.
All right. Let me ask you this about Bahrain. Let me ask you this. How would you explain Washington's silence on Saudi Arabia simply sending troops over there? Because Washington's official stance was, this is no invasion, there's nothing. And since then, there has been absolute silence from Washington over what's happening on the ground. Brutal killings, oppression, suppression against the people who are on the streets. Nothing from Washington. Any other factor other than Saudi Arabia and the Fifth Fleet Washington has?
I don't speak for President Obama's regime. I mean, for his I'm not his policy person, but I do know that he has made a statement saying that the U.S. supports the legitimate aspirations of those throughout the Arab world. Now, could we give more attention to what's going on in Bahrain? Absolutely.
All right, let's go to Washington, D.C.
We know that there's more than...
All right, let's go to Washington, D.C. Hossein Abdullah, let me ask you about Washington's policy here. All right, everyone knows that Bahrain is home to Washington's Fifth Fleet, basically Washington's Navy in the Middle East, where it controls the entire region. So a lot at stake for Washington. But apart from that, it's Saudi Arabia, a big ally in the Saudi lobby in Washington. What do you think explains Washington's policy toward Bahrain, the silence, if you will?
Look, when the uprising started in February 14th, the first response or first reaction from the White House and the State Department were somewhat positive, were somewhat welcomed by the people in Bahrain, by human rights activists, different political groups, because it was clear that Washington condemned violence in Bahrain. President Obama had a 40-minute conversation with the king. Many described it as something that the king did not really seen pleasant. Since the movement of Saudi troops, we've seen utter silence from Washington and the State Department, which indicate that somehow someone in the policy-making process there in the White House or the State Department decided that supporting the revolution or the uprising in Bahrain does not coincide with the interest of the country, of the United States and Bahrain. Or does not support the Fifth Fleet being in Bahrain. Although this calculation is wrong, this calculation does not have any evidence to support, because the people in Bahrain never protested against the American interests in the country. Not even a single flag, American flag, was burned in Bahrain during this recent uprising. This double standard policy that we support a movement somewhere like in Egypt and then we don't support the revolution in Bahrain is going to hurt the American interest in the region. And I think there is some kind of realization right now going on in Washington to that. You've seen some major American media started covering Bahrain. CNN has series on Bahrain started 2 days ago. MSNBC is reporting some kind of information on Bahrain. The State Department started talking about Bahrain reluctantly, not strongly, but reluctantly, that a political solution has to take place in the country. Security alone not going to resolve it. All these signs tell us that there is somehow some shift in the U.S. policy toward Bahrain.
All right, now let's go to the audience in Beirut, if I may. And I'd like to read this out to our panelists and audience. According to data from the U.S. Defense Security Cooperation Agency, the branch of the government that coordinates sales and transfers of military equipment to allies, the United States has sent Bahrain dozens of excess American tanks, armored personnel carriers, helicopter gunships. The U.S. has also given the Bahrain Defense Forces thousands of 38 caliber pistols, millions of rounds of ammunition, from large caliber cannon shells to bullets for handguns. To take one example, the U.S. supplied Bahrain with enough 50 caliber rounds used in sniper rifles and machine guns to kill every Bahraini in the kingdom four times over. Now, Beirut, I'd like to have your take on Washington and this supply of arms to the region and dictators as such, as opposed to this talk of democracy holding in the Middle East.
I just want to talk about the role of the United Nations. Why the United Nations sent soldiers to fight against the terror at Libya, and why the Saudis and the Qatars sent soldiers to fight the innocent people in Bahrain. This differentiation is not accepted. Just because the Bahrainian people are Shias, they must be killed, and their death became legal. I think that they are fighting for not human rights, but for religious rights, and this is not accepted at all.
All right,
and,
that's a good
also
question.
There must,
that's a good question. Why not?
I just say that there must be more media coverage, which make pressure at the regime. Thank you.
All right, why not another UN resolution, such as 1973 we had on the case of Libya about Bahrain? Any more comments from Beirut?
Okay, I need to go back first to media coverage point. I need to say that Bahraini people were successful in leaking the news and making the publicity of the crimes of the ruling system. And they have succeeded in doing this by using the social media. And two days ago, I heard the Minister of Health making a press conference and one of she kept claiming that there is a conspiracy in the hospital of Sulaymaniyah, and when she was asked by a journalist about what the system is going to do and how is the system going to judge the arrested or the suspected people, the minister said that there is a conspiracy, but she said that we need evidence. That means they are just building and making of their, they are claiming without having evidence. All the evidence are now in the hands of the Bahraini opposition, and they are leaking these evidence to outside world and they are trying to start in investigating. To call the international world to all start right. investigating all the crimes done during this revolution.
All right. Now, I see, yes, another comment from Beirut, and then we'll go to London.
You asked a question earlier as to why the U.S. might be helping Bahrain in terms of providing weapons. Well, there's a simple answer to that. It's because of Saudi Arabia. The U.S. has a vested interest in keeping Saudi Arabian oil flowing, and they want Saudi Arabia to keep on pumping oil. So as long as the U.S. relies on Saudi oil, it is U.S. interest to support Saudi Arabia. And if that means supporting Bahrain, they will do so.
All right, let's go to London. I see a hand raised for quite some time.
Question is to the panel. If there is a political solution to the social uprising in Bahrain and we see a democratic Shiite-led government, how would this domestic shift in the balance of power change America's geostrategic calculations in the region?
Oh, that was a great geopolitical question. We'll pose it definitely to the panel. But before that, let me ask the studio in London, where is UN on all of this? What do you think about UN's role?
I want to bring the point that how come the panelist in Boston didn't totally ignored my question and just
Let me pose your question.
Totally talk about something else. What I want to say, when is the West? When is the leaders of the Western countries going to stop thinking the Joe public is stupid and they're going to play the blame game? So it's about time that people's voices are heard. And I, to be honest with you, I've even lost faith with the UN. So answer your question there. So why don't they answer people's questions? You know, I mean, if they're not going to change the will of the people through elections, at least answer people's questions. And I've lost faith, to be honest with you.
All right, John Hajar, did you hear the question? Because he earlier posed a question.
I'll be happy to answer the question. You know, I don't, I'm not in a policy-making position, but you know, when you say it's not in the when you make these conspiracy theorist arguments, you seem to forget some very convenient facts. I mean, the U.S. went to war to defend the Shiite population of Iraq. The U.S. went to war in Bosnia to support the domestic Muslim population there. The U.S., we have given countless lives, we've given countless countless amounts of our treasure to support the rights, the legitimate rights of the people throughout the region.
So why not in Bahrain?
You claim that the U.S. is sowing insurrection, or you seem to imply that. I really don't know where, on what facts you're basing that. I mean, we are giving American lives in both Afghanistan and Iraq right now to support the legitimate aspirations of the local populations. So when you make that argument and completely forget the history of what this country stands for and the sacrifices that have been made by Americans over the years, I take offense at that, and I think it's really off base.
Washington, D.C., would you agree?
Look, as a Bahraini American, I come to this from two different perspectives. I understand very well the position of the United States. We our government, look after our interest in the region. We have a very calculated move. There is a process where we decide, or the policymaker decide, which revolution to support, and whether supporting that revolution is going to advance our interest in the region or is going to harm our interest. We supported the Shia in Iraq, or the majority of people in Iraq at the time of President Bush, that was the right thing to do for the American interest. Now in the Obama administration, somehow supporting the movement in Bahrain is not really picking up the steam. And I think they're wrong. I think they're off base there, or they're not taking the right decision. But I also understand that it's come from the position that which way is the best for the American interest in the region. But as a Bahraini American, as someone originally from Bahrain, I'm very disappointed from the stand of my administration, of my government.
All right, no.
I believe that supporting the democracy in Bahrain is the right way to support our interest in Bahrain, because the people of Bahrain never stood against the American interest in the country.
All right. Now, we have less than 5 minutes. There was a great question posed by the panel of audience in London. The question was about geopolitics, where this is going for the United States in terms of democratic moves in the region if they succeed. But the big question is, if they succeed, and to London, Saeed Shahabi, how do you see this thing happening in Bahrain? Where do you see the future of this going?
Well, now that the regime has opted to use the most ferocious forms of repression, I cannot see much bright future for the regime. I see that the people will pay more heavy price in terms of human casualties, but I think also that the West will be compelled one day, not very far from now, to intervene, to take a stand. Only 2-3 days ago, the Washington Post had an editorial questioning the legitimacy of the Obama administration's stand on Bahrain, in the same way as we are discussing it now. So I can see a shift in the international position in not so far a future, and I can see that the regime will be more brutal in the coming days, but I also can see that the people will be more steadfast more resilient in the face of these aggressions.
On that optimistic note, let's go to Beirut. What do you see, real quick?
Well, I think that for the time being, I don't see any prospects for of success in Bahrain for too many reasons, because the success of revolution in Bahrain will lead to major changes in other neighboring countries.
All right, not that optimistic. Not that optimistic. Let's go to Washington. Optimistic, pessimistic, what do you see? Do you see people winning this?
Look, as a student of history, I believe people will prevail at the end. Whether it comes on the short term or it's going to take some time, eventually people will prevail, and someone who rules with an iron fist
is going to
disappear eventually.
Two optimistic no's, one pessimistic one. Let's go to Bas and John Hajar. Do you think people will prevail?
I too am optimistic. I think in the long run, the course of history, the Arab and Islamic world have been denied, the people of those regions have been denied their legitimate rights for far too long. They watch what's happened in the Soviet Union when that fell. They've watched revolutions around the world, and they say, why not us? Well, it's your time. Keep the faith and keep protesting and doing what's right, and you'll get what you deserve.
All right. We have no time to go back to our panels of studio, but 3-1, this panel of experts simply believe the people will prevail the end of the day. That's something proven by history. We were joined from London by Saeed Shahabi, head of Bahrain Freedom Movement. From Beirut is Jamal Wakim, political analyst, Washington, D.C. Hossein Abdullah, director of Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain. Boston, John Hajar, U.S. director of Cedar is a Revolution. We were also joined from London and Beirut by our panels of audience. Thank you all for sharing your time with us. See you on our next link.